It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports
right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
This is Dan Friedel in for VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. The weekend feels as if it starts right now. There is so much to get excited for. We've got the much-anticipated Women's World Cup showdown between the Americans and the host French. The Africa Cup of Nations is captivating the continent. Wimbledon gets started in England. A busy NBA summer of free agency gets started this weekend, and there's even some baseball being played in a British soccer stadium. Let's welcome Samson Omale to get us caught up on the AFCON news.
2019 African Cup of Nations enters its day 8 on Friday with three fixtures. In the first match of the day at the Suisse Stadium, Mali will take on Tunisia. Mali are tipped as dark horses for the title. They recorded the biggest win of all teams in the opening round of matches, but will have their work cut out for them when they take on the second-ranked team on the continent, Tunisia. In the second game, Morocco will face Cote d'Ivoire, while the late kickoff will be a make-or-break tie for both South Africa and Namibia in the Southern African Derby after both nations fell to a 1-0 opening game defeat to Ivory Coast and Morocco. In Thursday's matches, Michael Olunga scored twice as Kenya edged neighbors Tanzania 3-2 in Cairo to keep their hopes alive of reaching the second round in the African Cup of Nations. The Japan-based forward equalized in the first half and scored the 80th-minute winner in a lively East African derby. Kenya's captain is Victor Wanyama, who plays for English Premiership side Tottenham Hotspur.
It has been difficult for us. We started badly, but today we bounced back. We went down, we came back again, you were trailing two times and we came back, we showed the fighting spirit and we showed what we are about. You know, when everyone is at it, we are a very good team.
In another Thursday fixture, Riyad Mahrez and Algeria fired a warning shot to the rest of their African Cup of Nations title rivals with a deserved 1-0 win over Sadio Mane's heavily fancied Senegal in Cairo. And elsewhere, African Cup of Nations double tour, Madagascar took a giant stride towards the next round as Marco Ilemhatira hammered home a late free kick to beat Burundi 1-0 in their Group B match on Thursday. Former Zambia football legend Kalusha Bwalya says the increase in the number of teams from 16 to 24 has made this year's tournament more competitive. Kalusha Bwalya, while assessing the performance of the so-called smaller nations, says the performance so far has shown that there is no more gap between the small teams and the so-called big teams on the continent.
The increment from 16 to 24, it is very, very encouraging. In Africa, there are no small teams. So for the teams that are not well-known or they have not had the privilege to qualify, you know, to the Africa Cup, like Benin or Kenya or Tanzania, Burundi, Madagascar, Mauritania. So these teams who have come, I think that they will bring something to the Africa Cup of Nations. I think they will bring a lot of enthusiasm to the Africa Cup of Nations, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that. But also I think that the teams that were in the big teams, of course, the teams were in the World Cup in last year, I think that they can have a big say in this Africa Cup.
I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
Thank you, Samson. And to update you on the match that just finished, Mali and Tunisia drew 1-1. One team already has a spot in the knockout round, and that's Nigeria. Iron Mike Mbonye got on the phone with Toyin Ibitoye, the press officer of the Super Eagles, to talk about the team's preparation for the final game of the group phase. Welcome to the show.
We have to go, but I'm not top of the group yet. Avoiding defeat in our last game, we stopped the group. But our philosophy is to the pitch, give our 100% to win, and that will not change in this last game against Madagascar. The boys are fired up, the boys are hungry, the boys want to finish well, after start well, and you want to do our best. So always go out there to win our game, and the approach will be different against Madagascar.
What is the mood in camp? Do you have injury worries after playing two matches?
Apart from the two
knocks before the game against Burundi and the other players are good to go. I'm talking about Shiwa Dulai and Jamilu Collins. All the other players are good to go. The 21 other players are fit and they are all available to be selected.
Talking about the remaining matches, is the team optimistic of going beyond the round of 16?
Yes, we want to go as far as possible. We want to go all the way. We want to make Nigerians proud by repeating what we did in 2013. But we have to be careful to take it one game at a time. Before us now is the game on Sunday against Madagascar. After that, we will know our opponents in the round of 16, and then we can take it one game at a time until the trophy is won on the 19th of July. So, yes, we want to go all the way, but we want to be careful to take it one step at a time.
What has been the support like from Nigerians resident in Egypt since you arrived?
Yes, we must commend the Nigerian embassy here. They've been able to mobilize some people to come out on March days to support us. The Nigerian students, of course, in Alexandria and from Cairo also have mobilized support for us. So we are major for support, and it could be more, definitely, but we are not lacking in support at all. And we hope, as we continue to do well and go forward in this competition, more Nigerians will come out in their numbers to be the truth player for us on the pitch.
Thank you, Mike. We'll have the news of that game on Monday's show. Keeping up with the world of soccer, this time with the women, we've mentioned that one of the most anticipated matches of the World Cup kicks off in about 2 hours. That's the defending champion United States against the host nation, France. Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal recently profiled the French team, and the headline says it all. The soccer team built to beat the U.S. Here's one note. Since winning the last World Cup 4 years ago, the Americans have played 75 matches and lost just 5 times, but they were beaten twice by the French team. In fact, the story goes on to say that the French players have both a grace and a strength that the Americans may not be able to match because of the investment that the French program has made recently in strength training, nutrition, and injury prevention. The Americans, ranked number one in the world, are just trying to stay on top while the French are rising. It'll be a compelling match for sure. The first quarterfinal match came on Thursday as England shut out Norway 3-0. The remaining 2 matches in the quarterfinals are on Saturday. Italy plays Netherlands and Germany faces Sweden. In keeping with soccer, VOA intern Ryan Handel has this report, continuing our theme of youth sports participation this week. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
We talked earlier this week here on the Sunny Side of Sports with Emily Stetz from the Aspen Institute about making sure kids have a good opportunity to play sports without feeling too much pressure about becoming great right away. For a different perspective, we're joined now by Brown University soccer coach Patrick Laughlin, who has seen soccer change, starting with his days as a young athlete in the 1980s to his college years in the 1990s, to his time evaluating young players as a soccer coach in the eastern United States. Brown, based in the eastern U.S. city of Providence, Rhode Island, competes in the Ivy League against universities like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Dartmouth. In recent years, the Bears have won about half their games, and in 2018, they had 4 players named to various all-Ivy League teams. I talked with Laughlin about how he thinks younger athletes should approach sports, including the benefits of playing recreationally and when players should specialize and play competitively if they want to compete at the collegiate level. We also spoke about how recruiting has changed in his time as an athlete and coach. Let's hear a bit about those changes.
It's changed greatly, and I think it's changed. I think youth soccer has continued to grow and develop, and I think it's changed for the better, and we're seeing more quality people and coaches involved in youth development for soccer, and it's been it's made more quality players. It's created a better environment for learning, and when we're looking at guys, seeing players that are far advanced from when I was being recruited and I was a young player, and there's more good soccer players throughout the United States, not just in certain pockets of the country. They're good players are coming from all different states and all different rural, urban, suburban environments, all different environments.
That's Brown University soccer coach Patrick Laughlin. On an earlier show, Emily Stets noted that there may not be enough opportunities for kids to simply play. Rather, there can sometimes be a focus on wins and losses from a young age. Let's hear what Laughlin thinks about that issue.
I think there are enough opportunities to play recreationally. I think, you know, you don't want to have any young person lose their interest in sports, in a variety of sports or in athletics. And the decision to specialize or to think, well, I would like to try to play this sport in college should be something that's done, I think, later in the teenage years, but also done with the young person along with the parent's support or guidance in that situation.
In addition to his answer, Laughlin also emphasized the value of playing recreational sports as a way for kids to make friends and learn how to play on a team. We've been talking this week with Emily Stets from the Aspen Institute about ways to make sure kids have an opportunity to play multiple sports. This is what she calls sports sampling, and she thinks that's a good idea because it can help keep kids interested in sports and make sure they don't suffer from what's known as overuse injuries.
As a former multi-sport athlete myself, I never quite understood exactly the value of what that would do for kids and the compounded benefits you get until I now started this work and saw that it is to everyone's benefit that kids are able to rest their muscles and their bodies, not only physically, but also to get into a new space, new teammates, different kind of season, different kind of sports is immensely beneficial from an anecdotal perspective.
That's Emily Stets from the Aspen Institute. The Institute has a tool that parents can use to help decide which sports their children might like to pursue. It's called the Healthy Sport Index, and you can find it at healthysportindex.com. When it comes to evaluating potential college soccer players, we asked Laughlin, the Brown University coach, whether he'd prefer to have a team made up of players who had played exclusively soccer from a young age, or those who had experience with multiple sports.
There's good qualities if you've been focused on soccer your whole life, and there's good qualities if you've been playing more than one sport. I think if everything is equal, then you have to make a choice, but rarely is it equal. Usually there's something about a person that you like more. So I wouldn't say I go out of my way to say, oh, I don't want someone that's a multi-sport athlete, and I don't go out of my way to say I don't want someone who's just a soccer player.
Both Coach Laughlin and Emily Stets agree that kids shouldn't be concerned that playing multiple sports could negatively impact them in the future. It's only in the later teenage years that it might be worth specializing in just one sport. Back to you, Dan.
That's VOA intern Ryan Handel with the report, and I'm Dan Friedel. You're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. While Wimbledon is on everyone's mind, my VOA colleague Jim Stevenson is here with his tennis segment of the Game Room podcast to catch up on all the goings-on in that sport ahead of Wimbledon.
Means more than almost some of the singles tournaments that I won.
Andy Murray of Scotland has made an amazing comeback, undergoing hip surgery that he feared might end his tennis career. And now, winning the men's doubles title at Queen's Club.
It's a special, special week for me for a lot of different reasons. I didn't know if I was going to be back competing at this level again a few months ago.
Murray teamed with Feliciano Lopez to score a 7-6, 5-7, 10-5 victory over American Rajiv Ram and Britain's Joe Salisbury. Lopez came into the final after having won the Queen's Club singles title.
No, probably the best one ever. Yeah, I said before, no, how difficult it is to win here in singles that I won both. I cannot believe that. I don't know how to explain in words, because now I won the singles immediately. We played the doubles. We just won it. Everything happened so quick. So, you know, I need time, you know. I need a glass of wine to think about everything that happened this week. But I'm so, so happy. It's been the best week of my life.
Murray was inspired to team with Lopez, with whom he found a natural playing rhythm.
For Feli, I mean, just a brilliant, brilliant week. And it's just amazing to see someone who's been on the tour for that long giving that much effort and, you know, so pumped and such a brilliant attitude. It's just great to see. And he deserved, I thought, to win the singles. It was a brilliant match. But, you know, in the doubles, he came up with some brilliant stuff at the end as well. So amazing, amazing week for him. Very well deserved.
Murray's comeback streak was abruptly cut short, losing in the first round of the Eastbourne International with makeshift partner Marcelo Melo of Brazil. Still, Murray is tempted by the prospects of playing Wimbledon and beyond.
I sort of have a bit of a decision to make. I either sort of set a goal of maybe trying to play singles like post US Open, and then I would maybe do a few weeks training, like two weeks training after Wimbledon, and then maybe keep going with some doubles through the US Open swing, or you take a little bit more time to train and maybe give myself 3 or 4 weeks, like another month of building up and playing some singles. I could potentially try just before then, maybe at some of the tournaments like, you know, Cincinnati or Winston-Salem.
Murray has 5 Queen's Club singles titles to go with his newly earned doubles crown. His biggest win is the absence of debilitating pain he was feeling before hip surgery. Murray says he will take his time to find his way from here.
I'm just really happy that my body's fine. I'm feeling good and I'm healthy. And, you know, I'm going to take my time. I'm not going to rush this because I don't want to and I don't need to. So if it means not playing singles until a bit later, fine. I'm just happy to be back on the court and no pain in my hip.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
The great Roger Federer of Switzerland continues to amaze tennis fans and himself.
Never really thought about how it would feel if I won, and now it's reality. First time ever I could win a title 10 times in one place, so it's obviously a very special moment in my career.
Federer won a record-extending 10th Halle Open title, defeating Belgian David Goff in 7-6, 6-1 in 1 hour 25 minutes.
He was a better player for probably the first 10 games of the match. He had more chances. He had big chances too, and then I played a really good tiebreaker. I was able to run away with the lead, you know, getting the break early on in the second, and I think that maybe calmed down my nerves. His level might have dropped just a tiny bit, but it was tough to play, you know, with the shadow. It's fast court.
The match marked Federer's 13th final in Halle and his third trophy this year, following wins in Miami and Dubai. He was surprised he had a chance.
It's amazing. Some reason I never thought I was going to make it anymore. Didn't think of it much. I just thought match for match, and because the second round of quarters was so tough.
The win bodes well for Federer as he has his sights set on the biggest grass court tournament of the year. Of his record 20 Grand Slam titles, 8 have come at Wimbledon.
Look, every time I won in Halle, I went on to play really well at Wimbledon. So I think, I mean, there's never a guarantee, of course, but I've been on the tour for long enough to know what it means. And also, most important is that I know I'm injury free. I'm going to have a couple of days off, I guess, and then get ready once I'm going to be in Wimbledon practicing there again.
Thanks for that, Jim. I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. In keeping with our tennis-filled show, my colleague Steve Miller is here now with a conversation about how they set up the seedings for the tournament at Wimbledon. Sporty greetings, Steve.
And a sporty greetings to you, Dan. So, I guess we should first say that the formula being employed by Wimbledon organizers dates back to 2002 and is really only used for men's singles. This year, the formula has allowed 8-time champion Roger Federer to be placed as the number 2 seed ahead of world number 2 Rafael Nadal. And that's not all that's going on. Last year's finalist, Kevin Anderson, moved up 4 spots from his number 8 world ranking to the number 4 seed. Now, Novak Djokovic said that he was surprised at the Wimbledon rankings, but he also acknowledged it's their rules and you have to respect them.
Even though it's Roger, I mean, Roger is, you know, the greatest of all time, and of course, you know, he won most Wimbledon titles of any player in history, and you know, if anyone deserves it, it's him. But at the same time, you know, it's Nadal that he's kind of taking over the second seed, you know. So it is surprising, to be honest, a little bit, but you know, it is what it is.
So how exactly does this Wimbledon formula work? Well, it takes the ATP ranking points that were available as of June 24th and then adds 100% of the points from the past 12 months. It also adds 75% of the points from grass matches that were taking place before the 2018 Wimbledon tournament, which brings us to the current seedings. Nadal didn't enter any pre-Wimbledon events during the past 3 weeks. However, Roger Federer did. He participated in the Halle tournament, and he actually went home with the trophy, taking home his 10th championship last weekend. And it's specifically that victory that gave him the boost that he needed to overtake Nadal in the Wimbledon standings. Now, Nadal did speak with Spanish television station Vamos on Tuesday, and he said that he didn't think Wimbledon having its own seeding formula was a good idea. Now, this all does mean that Nadal could be drawn up against Djokovic, who's the top-ranked player. And he also beat Nadal last year. That's all I have. Back to you, Dan.
Thank you, Steve. That's Steve Miller, and I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to this Friday edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. With even more tennis news, Ryan Handel is back to give us a preview of one of the most intriguing first-round matchups at Wimbledon, featuring both an African-American tennis legend and an African-American rising star. Sporty greetings, Ryan.
Sporty greetings, Dan. We saw the youth movement in women's tennis in full force at the French Open when 17-year-old Amanda Anisimova made the semifinals. But an even younger player is already making waves at Wimbledon, 15-year-old American Coco Gauff. Gauff has long been touted as a future star, especially after she won the 2018 French Open junior title. However, her performance this weekend in Wimbledon qualifying still shocked the world. She won all three qualifying rounds without dropping a single set to make the main draw. 11 players younger than Gauff have played in Wimbledon, but Gauff is the youngest player ever to battle through qualifying to make the tournament. Gauff's reward for making the main draw? A matchup with one of the all-time greats in women's tennis, Venus Williams. The match will pair the 39-year-old Williams, the oldest player in the draw, with Gauff, the youngest. Venus played her first professional match in 1994. Gauff was born in 2004. Williams had already won 4 Grand Slams before Gauff was out of the womb. Another thing that makes this match interesting, besides the age gap, is the parallels between Williams and Gauff. Both are Americans, they share similar physical attributes and playstyles, and they have similar trajectories as young players. Whether or not Gauff wins this match, she could be well on her way to a Venus-like career. You'll definitely want to tune in to this battle of experience versus young talent.
Thanks, Ryan. So there are a few other early round matches. What are some of the first round matches at Wimbledon that you're looking forward to?
Well, one men's match I'm looking forward to would be between fourth-seeded South African Kevin Anderson and Frenchman Pierre-Hugues Herbert. Anderson has struggled with injuries this year, while Herbert's had good form lately, including a win over the 13th-ranked Daniil Medvedev at the French Open. Anderson should be on upset alert. For the women, the first round match between Su Weishe of Chinese Taipei and Helena Ostapenko of Latvia should be highly entertaining. She likes to confound other players with drop shots, while Ostapenko prefers to overpower her opponents. So the contrasting styles should make for a good match.
Thanks so much for that report, Ryan. We'll be looking forward to those results over the weekend. One quick note, Northern Virginia native Kara Lawson named to the Boston Celtics coaching staff. Kara grew up and played high school basketball just about 15 kilometers away from Voice of America headquarters here in Washington, D.C. That wraps up the June 27th edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Nick Ivanov. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Dan Friedel, filling in for VOA's Sunny Young in Washington. Sunny will be back soon. And that's The Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it. Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the newly elected Nigerian United Nations General Assembly President pledges to focus on peace and prosperity for the most vulnerable. Nigeria at the helm of the UNGA on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
This is Science in a Minute.
For the first time ever, astronomers detected and then pinpointed the origination of a single fast radio burst, or FRB. A fast radio burst is just that, a very powerful and quick, lasting only a couple of milliseconds, blast of radio waves that are transmitted from far across the universe. Astronomers at the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder Radio Telescope in Western Australia detected the radio burst, known as FRB 180924, in September 2018. They determined that it originated in a Milky Way-sized galaxy located within the Grú constellation, about 3.6 billion light-years away. To learn more about the galactic source of the FRB, the astronomers used the European South Observatory's 8-meter Very Large Telescope, the 10-meter Keck Telescope, and the 8-meter Gemini South Telescope to image and measure distance. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscast. Every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA News. I'm Liz Palka. Many